Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 15, 2003, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche gave the keynote address entitled "This Is Our Time" at the President's Day Conference of the International Caucus of Labor Committees and Schiller Institute, convened in Reston, Virginia. This week, part one of his keynote is presented as the first of a series of programs dedicated to this historic conference.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Spanos, and I want to welcome you who are in this room and those of our webcast audience to the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute and ICLC. This is a semi-annual event of the LaRouche political movement. Because we are webcasting the entirety of this conference, I want to alert you that we shall be adhering to the schedule, as you see we are right now. And I urge you to plan to be here at the scheduled time for every session. This is the youngest conference of the LaRouche movement we've had in quite some time, say probably decades. And that's good because we have a revolution to make in very short order. Ours will be a Republican revolution even greater than that of 1776, when a group of young whippersnappers, such as Alexander Hamilton, Matthew Carey, John Quincy Adams, and James Monroe, responded to the leadership of the octogenarian genius, Benjamin Franklin. Of course, we have our own octogenarian genius in Lyndon LaRouche. And therefore, our revolution will be all the greater. I expect this conference will be a turning point in the minds and lives of many of you as you turn your attention to posterity and against the fear of immortality. And in that respect, I want to note, sadly, that 1 month ago, our movement lost to immortality one of its longtime members, Marianna Wirtz. Marianna was the wife of our beloved colleague Will Wirtz, vice president of the Schiller Institute, and a major spark behind the Schiller Institute's activity. I'm very pleased that we were able to honor Marianna's wish by bringing out a reprint of Amelia Boynton Robinson's biography in time for this conference. And I'm told that Amelia will autograph copies tomorrow. In the meantime, we will be having a tribute to Marianna and the way she lived her life this evening. But right now, I want to present to you the woman who will introduce our keynote speaker, Schiller Institute leader and civil rights heroine, Amelia Boynton Robinson.
Look forward to these conferences. And since all of my life, especially adult life, I have been working with young people. They are my heart. And I feel that the only way we are going to be able to make progress is to stick with our leader. In fact, our leaders that are the best in the whole world. We know what is going on now. We realize that this world, this universe, is millions of years old. We don't know how many millions. But when we find artifacts where they have been excavated and they show human beings who have been in this world millions of years ago, we had better take a second thought and realize that we can go along with other civilizations if we don't follow the leader that God has given us, the leader who is not just another one, one who has been endowed with a different type of just ordinary living, a leader who is one that is an economist, a scientist, and one who really knows the rope. So if we follow, God makes leaders. They don't just jump up and be a leader. God ordains them to be leaders. So we have to save this world. And if it is to be saved, it will take the leaders of Schiller Institute and the members and people who will work with us. Looking at this sign, this is our time. And if we don't realize that the time passes, and if this is our time, we cannot wait and say, we'll see what's going on. Because if we just go on and accept what is going on, we all will find that we are slaves. Slaves to the system. Slaves that we criticize other countries whose people are not free. Slaves to ourselves because we'll be like the people back then, the time when I worked under the United States Department of Agriculture, where people were afraid to think for themselves. Why? Because they thought they had to go along with the system. And we will find ourselves in the same condition if we don't work together. And I heard Lyndon LaRouche say, we can save this world. And I believe that it can be done, but no one person can do it by himself. It takes people, it takes dedicated people, it takes people who realize that nothing is impossible with God. I think of what we are doing, going through now, and how the information we are getting from those who are inspecting Iraq, and I think of our president who circumvents everything that seems to be a light. And I think of a story that I heard, because the president always says that we are going in, come high hell or high water, we are going into Iraq. It reminds me of a story of a woman who had a son. She thought a whole lot of the son, but he had to go to the army. Finally, this group of soldiers came to the town, and she notified the whole town to turn out. My son Mickey is in the army, and Mickey is going to be marching with the army. And finally, they came in. And as they came in, they had the step, right, left. Right, left. Finally, she looked around and she saw Mickey. And she said, oh, there goes Mickey. Everybody's out of step but Mickey. When they said right, Mickey would put his left foot out. And when they said left, Mickey's right foot went out. And he said, everybody's out of step but Mickey. Everybody's out of step but our president, I'm sorry to say. So we have a leader. We're going to follow him. And we are going to turn this country around, the attitude of those people who are chicken hawks. And we are going to do it because we are going to follow a leader who needs no more introduction. But I would say, when we get together, when we work together for a common cause, we will do like I have said before, those people who figure that they can destroy the world, they can do what they want. They have left out love. They have left out understanding. They have left out communication. And they are on the outside of the circle, but they have drawn a circle. And they think that they can control the whole world. And I think of what I have said before, and that is, they drew a circle and left us out. Heretic rebel, a thing to flout. But love, Schiller Institute, Lynn and Helga have drawn a circle that's so large that it has taken them in with love. I present to you the man who has the spirit, he has the message, Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Over the past 6 months or so, up until about a week ago, even a few days ago, I was hearing from people in leading positions throughout the world, more and more, this war must not happen, but it cannot be stopped. Therefore, you have to go along with it. And as the time passed, there were ebbs and flows in the moods, pessimism, optimism, modest optimism. But they persistently, again and again, this war is terrible. It must not happen. But it is inevitable. It cannot be stopped. Don't get in the way. Prepare to do something later. The United States will be discredited. Bush will be discredited. Wait, wait, be smart. Don't fight them now. I didn't agree. And I shall deal with that subject of agreeing or not agreeing to such things here today. But the point happened, as you observed a couple of days ago, now in the United Nations. You saw nations which, in point of fact, represent the overwhelming majority of the human race, saying directly or echoing the sentiments of other nations, it shall not happen. And if there are 100 million people who want in the world as a whole, of the 6 billion who actually want the war, I have it difficult to believe that. Very small number actually believes in this war. And only a few very bad people actually wish it. So we've come to a point that the war is still not prevented. But we have seen the world move from a point of pessimism about an inevitable war to a strong conviction, even from leaders of nations who had shown cowardice or wavering beforehand, who are now determined on behalf of the human race as a whole, this war shall not happen. A great lesson. It reminds me, of course, and should remind you of Abraham Lincoln, who on one occasion said that you can fool all of the people some of the time, and over the past 40 years, we've seen a lot of that. You can fool some of the people all the time, and we see that today, especially in Washington, and in stockbroking circles. But you cannot fool all of the people all the time. Sometimes this fact requires great patience on the part of people. Sometimes the patience is stretched over generations. Great injustices prevail. Unnecessary great wars happen repeatedly. But nonetheless, sooner or later, again and again, the people realize they cannot be fooled all of the time. We have now come to the point that fooling is at the vanishing point. Now we have to reflect. We have not yet had a victory. We must take strength from what we've accomplished thus far to find more energy to win the victory which still eludes us. But we should take strength from what we have accomplished so far in seeing the majority of the human race express directly and indirectly its determination that what we fought against shall not happen. And therefore, having come this far, this close to victory, it's time to examine the basis for our near victory, to adduce that principle of victory, and to consciously apply it now to make our victory total. In the recent period, since I delivered a State of the Union message on the 28th of January, I had to deliver it because nobody else was going to do so. The president couldn't make it till he delivered. I issued two reports on a fairly large scale, especially to Democratic National Committee circles and others. One on the subject of the response of the Democratic Party leaders, the nominees, to the war situation. And we find that all of them have failed. They either acceded to Bush on the question of the war, or they admired him on the question, or they opposed it in two cases without either one case saying nothing, just opposing it, and the other case saying they would regret if it could. But there was no leadership from these candidates of the Democratic Party or other speaking spokesmen of the National Democratic Committee against this war. Then I wrote a letter to the Democratic National Committee, which is now available to you, which I outline some of the things which I will expand upon here and lay out here. Let me start with some diagrams which we have. Again, the standard triple curve, number one. No, the number one curve, it's triple curve. Do you have that? Or don't you?
Okay.
What I want to emphasize is what has happened to us, especially during the past 40 years. To get a picture of what Lincoln's aphorism means, that you can fool all the people most of the time, or some of the time, some of the people all of the time, but not all of the people all the time. This is a picture in general, which you've seen many times from me. This is what's happened to the U.S. economy and much of the world economy since 1966, since the U.S. budget of the year 1966-67 fiscal year. What has happened over this period, up until about the year 1999-2000, is depicted in thus. First, at the top, there's been a growth of financial aggregates. At the same time, there has been a decline in per capita actual physical output in the U.S. economy and other economies. That is, the economy has been shrinking while the money value of the economy has been increased as measured in financial terms. This growth of financial assets has been driven by an increase of monetary pumping by the Federal Reserve and other financial institutions, monetary institutions. So they've been pumping money into a collapsing economy to increase the price of a diminishing product of the economy as a whole. Let's take the next one in the series. All right. Now you come to the following. As a turning point in September of 1998 in the U.S. economy. In August of 1998, Al Gore's agreement or his deal with Boris Yeltsin, then the president of Russia, the 1996 agreement, to pull a giant swindle on the world, including some criminal types that Al was involved in, with Golden Ada and things like that. A part of this was apart from looting Russia, by Al's friend, Mark Rich, whose lawyer is Lawrence Libby, or was Lawrence Libby, who runs the office of Vice President Cheney. Now, they came up with another swindle called the GKO bonds. It was a swindle, a pure paper swindle, which involved hedge funds in New York and elsewhere. The whole financial system was about to collapse in August of 1998 when this hedge fund collapse on the GKO Russian bonds occurred. At that point, the President of the United States, in that period, together with his Treasury Secretary, indicated, and the President publicly, in an address he gave in September in New York City to the New York Council on Foreign Relations, the need for reform of the international monetary financial system. He did not do it. Now, I'll let him tell you in his own words, on his own time, why he didn't do it. It has to do with a stalker in the basement of the White House and a scandal that was done to prevent him from even threatening to do it. As a result of that, in October of that year, 1998, there's a Washington Monetary Conference, various nations coming in tiers and teams, and they adopted a policy. The policy was based on the fear, which I expressed at the time and which they felt, that the Brazil currency was about to have a blowout similar to the so-called Asia crisis of 1997 and the Russian bond crisis of 1998, to have by about February of 1999. So these fellows met together with George Soros and his type, the drug pusher, that is, the swindler drug pusher. And George recommended to them a policy they called a wall of money. That is, a great increase in the amount of money being dumped into the system, printed by governments or central banking systems or similar methods, to try to prevent the collapse from occurring. Now, let's go back to the chart. What happened is, early in 1999, we began to pick up indications that at least at that time,
The amount of monetary aggregate being pumped out of the Federal Reserve System and similar institutions exceeded the amount of financial assets they were rolling over or bailing out by that method. Now, this kind of thing occurred previously, most famously, in June of 1923, when an increase of printing of Reichsmarks by the German central bank, the Reichsbank, resulted in what became the hyperinflation of Germany of June 1923 to November 1923, the famous hyperinflation of Germany. Again, we watched this, and then in the spring of 2000, I was convinced that this was not an episodic development as a result of the wall of money policy, but this was a long-term development. That meant the United States economy had entered into a crisis phase, as I indicated that summer of the year 2000. And on that basis, I had made warnings in the presidential campaign of that year of this problem. And when, before 43 was actually inaugurated, that is George Bush II, the Empress Bush II, I indicated what was going to happen to the economy under his presidency. And it has all happened, as I shall indicate. So the United States, as of that point, as of no later than this period between the spring of 1999 and the spring of the year 2000, had already entered what is a terminal collapse of the world's present monetary financial system. That is, the amount of money that must be printed to keep the financial system from collapsing is greater than the amount of financial value being propped up by that mechanism. That is the classical mechanism for a pure hyperinflation. The alternative to a hyperinflation is a hyperdeflation, a collapse beyond belief. The greatest financial collapse in modern history is the alternative if we simply let the system go this way. All right, now let's go to the more detailed picture of this, what happened to the income of people of the United States over this period from 1966 to the present. Okay? What has happened is, you see, this again, year 2000. Over the period, and you'll see another figure on this, from 1997, the day that Brzezinski became president of the United States, until the year 2000, the lower 20%, the lower 80% of the family income brackets of the United States have been sinking, while the share of income of the upper 20% of family income brackets was increasing.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of LaRouche's keynote address to the ICLC Schiller Institute President's Day Conference. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's keynote from our President's Day Conference 2003.
Let's go to the next chart. We'll explain what this means. All right. Now what's happened is that the lower 20, not only is the lower 20% getting, lower 80% getting less income than the upper 20%, but a catastrophe has occurred in the upper 20%. In the lower half of the upper 20% since the year 2000-2001, the people who were making money, they thought, on the so-called information age, have lost billions, trillions. Many of them are wiped out. You see it on the highway from Dulles Airport to Washington, D.C. It's a ghost town, waiting for the deputy sheriff there to show you around the ghost town. All right, now next. Now look here. We're going to 1977. Brzezinski has been made the acting president of the United States. Carter gets out there and delivers the messages. Huh? But look what happened until 1982. Look at the collapse of the U.S. share, lower 20% of households of the United States. A catastrophe hit people in the lower income brackets as a result of loss of agriculture, particularly marginal agriculture, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and similar kinds of occupation. And it stumbled along like that, and it's now taken, in the most recent period, a further drop. You see again, next one. You see again, just a picture of what's happened. The collapse in the number of production workers, people actually producing, manufacturing, farmers. All right, next one. Now, here's an interesting thing. I called attention to this at the end of 1983. And the beginning of 1984, I delivered a nationwide network television broadcast, which I featured this. I reported then that the Federal Reserve System and the Commerce Department and some other folks had introduced a piece of fakery they called a quality adjustment index. And what they were doing was concealing the actual collapse of the economy. It was a political move by what they called adding quality adjustment factors to try to explain away the rise in prices and the collapse in the quality of automobile vehicles and other things that people were buying. Right? So what this has done is that, as Reggie Freeman and the staff have pointed out, is that when the mean price for an automobile today, new car, $23,000 approximately in the U.S., is actually equivalent, without this fake factor, to a $9,000 approximately price tag today. So when you're paying $23,000, you're getting, in terms of 1984 dollars, you're getting $9,000 worth at most. So therefore, the report on inflation in the United States has been faked by this method consistently over the past period since 1983-1984. Next. The same picture. Here's the same picture, but seen from a different standpoint. And then next, finally. Here's a picture of what's happened to the labor force. We have gone from a producer society to a consumer society. We live by looting the rest of the world. We destroy employment, productive employment, in our own country. Look, for example, workers, right? About half. Farm, half. But then look at working physicians. What happened to your health care? How was it looted? So what you've seen is this transformation of the United States from all its faults, the world's leading producer society in terms of physical output per capita and per square kilometer of the planet, up until about 1964, about the time that the Vietnam War began, and a degeneration of the United States into an imperial society which lives not by producing wealth at home, but lives by looting the rest of the world, using the imperial military and financial muscle of the United States to force other countries to feed us on a slave wage production budget. So therefore, we've come to the point where that system is now in a fatal collapse. It's a systemic collapse. The system in its present form can never be saved. Now, these facts that I just summarized with aid of these charts to you are facts that were essentially available to anybody who cared to look since 1954, when I began studying this as an economist, looking at the effect of Arthur Burns' influence on the policies of the Eisenhower administration. The first recession that I forecast, which I came in fairly close on, I said it was going to happen in February, and it did. Made the forecast in late 1956, and came in February 1957. Was a result strictly of what I showed at that time to be Arthur Burns' policies. We had changed the character of our policy in this monetarist direction. Remember, Arthur Burns is the guy who invented Milton Friedman out of mud. Milton Friedman was studying accounting at a New Jersey accounting school. And through some misfortune, He fell into the hands of Arthur Burns, who was then a leading influence and a professor at Columbia University, and a strong influence on the economic policies of the Eisenhower administration. And he converted this lump of mud into a Chicago University economist. He never became a successful economist, but he got a tremendous reputation. Wasn't worth anything, but he had it, you know, one of those things. So this, the system has been being destroyed systematically since about the time Kennedy was assassinated, and similar things happened in various parts of the world. The fact that it was going in that direction, I've been talking about all these years, saying if this continues, if this continues, if this continues, if this continues, and I've never been wrong. Now, this is not a test of my particular genius, because anybody who had used their heads and looked at the same facts I looked at, which are commonly available facts, would have come to the same conclusion. But what was wrong? Why didn't they see it? And all these professors of economics at universities, all these government officials, why did they offer all these years, when it was apparent as early as 1954, 1956, they were headed in the wrong direction? Why did nobody speak up and say, let's go back to the system that we had before this, the Roosevelt system? Because of what is called popular opinion. You can't go against popular opinion. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Well, I proved you can do it. And I told people at one conference exactly how you put toothpaste back in a tube. A very simple operation. To anyone who knows the elements of production. But we've been saying all these years, people, you've got to go along with popular opinion. You can't go against the news media. You can't go against public opinion. People believe. You can't hurt people's feelings by telling them they're stupid. So we went this way, and as Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool all of the people all the time. And for 40 years, they were doing a pretty good job of it. And people were fooled, which is what you fooled people are called fools. Unfortunately, these fools also voted. These fools also took over top positions in our leading corporations. These fools made the policies of our state and federal government. We have been gloriously fooled. And as Abe Lincoln said, it just goes to show you can fool most of the people all the time. And it's been done again. So what we're coming to is the tail end or the fag end of a process. No longer can people continue to be fooled about the economy. The way they try to fool them about the economy these days is they try to start a war in Iraq, a war against Islam, a crazy war, a war which is in violation of all morality. No person can advocate this war and consider themselves a moral person. It cannot be done. There are standards in warfare, especially in modern civilization. The issue of justified warfare is a clear issue. The issue of what is unjustified war is clear. Preventive war is known to be an evil for which people go to the gibbet in places like Nuremberg trials. And despite that, people are advocating preventive war again, as Bertrand Russell had advocated preventive nuclear war back in 1945-46, publicly. The Bertrand Russell, who's responsible for the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, called a pacifist, because the dead are very peaceful, especially the radioactive dead. So this has been the problem. The problem is our morals, our economy have disintegrated, our culture has disintegrated, because people allowed themselves to be fooled most people most of the time. And only a rare bunch of people have not been fooled. Most said, watch your rear end. Watch your back. Don't go against popular opinion. You got to listen to popular opinion. Then there's another side to this thing. How are people fooled? How do you become a fool? You say, well, I can't be concerned with these big things. I've got to think about my local constituency. I've got to think about my neighborhood, my township, my special constituency, my glitch. I can't be involved in big politics. We got to start at the base. You know what I mean? The base. At the bottom, that is. And when you dig at the bottom hard enough and long enough, where you end up? Deeper at the bottom. Which is what's happened to people who do that. So what we're dealing with here is known in classical art as classical tragedy. The United States, the people of the United States in particular, are a classical tragedy. Now, idiots who don't know how to teach or who do know how to misteach will tell you that tragedies involve the failures of leaders, the societies, these nice, honest, poor people, the people of popular opinion, are misled by leaders who betray them. But the people are always right. But they're these conniving leaders who betray them. It's not true. Not true. Who elected these leaders? Who elected the leaders you voted for? The ones that betrayed you. You did. You elected them by either voting for them or not voting. You elected them by not using your head about what you were doing in your choice to vote or your choice not to vote. You probably set out there as a populist, say, I never vote. I don't want to be responsible for what happens to this government. So the problem here is tragedy is always the people. And all the great classical tragedians have emphasized that, the ones that were any good. Except in some schools, they try to convince you that's not the case. But the cause for the collapse of humanity is always popular opinion. Like the ancient Roman Empire. The rottenness of the ancient Roman Empire was the rottenness of popular opinion, vox populi, the opinion of the people. Now, that I'm not saying that people are naturally rotten. They're not. I'll say quite the contrary. But people behave as if they were naturally rotten. And that's how we get into these messes called tragedies. And then the people who have become rotten in this sense select leaders who will not be offensive to their rottenness. Leaders like Lieberman, owned by organized crime. Leaders like Senator McCain, owned by organized crime. Gore, if he knows who he's owned by, is actually owned by organized crime, international Russian-related organized crime. So people elect people who are owned by organized crime. The entire crowd that is running the war policy of the Bush administration now are people who are owned outright by well-known international organized crime, such as Mark Rich, such as the Lansky mob, such as the Bronfman mob, such as Max Fisher, so forth and so on. This is the mob. These are the criminals. They're just too wealthy to put in jail. Or they probably take over the jail, run it. All right, but people vote for the choices of these criminal types. The politicians who are owned by them, like McCain. McCain's family wealth comes from the Bronfman family. The Democratic Leadership Council was created by organized crime. Organized crime. Gore was an influence for international organized crime called the Russian Mafia, and so forth and so on. But why did this happen? There were other leaders, there were other people on the scene. Why weren't they elected? Some were once in a while. But why were these guys elected? Because the people voted for them. The people voted for them. Or the people thought, I have to go along with the local newspaper. I have to go along with the local television show, the mass media. The people allowed themselves to be corrupt. And this is a large part of human history. It's empires, nations, cultures which destroyed themselves by selecting leaders who conformed to their choice of cultural standards.
This is what's destroyed the United States from the inside. We moved away from the standard of public opinion, which we developed under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt, in getting this nation out of a hopeless depression and saving the world from domination by Adolf Hitler. Now, Roosevelt was not a perfect man, and who can claim to be perfect? But his leadership was the difference which organized a movement inside the United States to rescue the United States from a terrible depression, to rescue the world from Hitler and what that represented, and to bring the United States from a depression in 1929-1933 to emerge from the war as the only world power, economic power, as really the only world power, with the highest level of productivity in this planet. And then we began to destroy what we had built. I was there, I saw it. I know exactly how it happened. I saw the corruption of the people, I saw the corruption of the people around me who had been pro-Roosevelt, who would not put up with this. But the minute the so-called right-wing turn came in the United States in 45, 46, 47, people who I thought were human went the other way. And they became the parents of the baby boomers. Right? And that's what happened to our society. So we get to a point where my experience is unique in the sense that I have been fighting against the so-called leadership of parties, government, and so forth for some years. And I've been right on these issues. And looking back today to what happened over those periods, it was known I was right. I was right when I said what was going to happen to Carter in 1976 if he were elected under Brzezinski's direction. I was right at what was planned for Bush when they were running him for president in 1979-1980. I was right on the issue of Mondale. I was right on the other issues. I was right in the year 1992. I was right in 1996. I was right in 2000. And events show it clearly right now. But why were there so much? Some people agree, no question about that. But why were we so few? Why could the people not see themselves going into the pit as I described it over the past period since 1996? Why wasn't it evident to them? Because of popular opinion. Now, God works in mysterious ways, they say. And we have to understand this, and we have to arise out of the little me view of history. The progress of humanity has been a progress of degradation, cycles of degradation, followed by those crises in which man has come to his senses and taken a step upward. And then often after that, man has again slipped back into degradation. The classic reference for this is a letter written by Solon of Athens, the man who freed the Athenians of a horrible system, who in his older age, after traveling in various parts of the world, Egypt and elsewhere, returned to Athens and found them becoming depraved again. And he wrote this letter, which is actually a letter which inspired, in large degree, the founders of the United States. Letter on the concept of the Republic, just as Plato's Republic, is so-called, was the basis, the initiative, actually, for conceiving of what the United States was founded to become. So what's happened in history is that from time to time,
in moments of crisis, there has emerged a leadership which has been capable of addressing a people who realize we've been wrong. When the people come to a time, they realize we've been wrong. Popular opinion has been wrong, as popular opinion about money should have been proven wrong to a lot of people recently. They're convinced we're in a crisis. The danger of great senseless wars sweeping over this planet convinces people that something is wrong, that drastic change is occurring. You can say that what you saw in the reflected in the Security Council this past week on the question of the Iraq War, you saw something approximating a revolution in nations, governments, which you would have thought several months earlier would never have had the courage to stand up as they stood up then. They didn't do a perfect job, but they stood up. A revolution is in process in this world. Whether it will succeed or not is not clear. But in times of great crisis, such as that brought on humanity by the past 40 years in the United States, you come to a point where humanity has the opportunity to rectify its error, where people become awakened, as Lincoln said, that to a point where you cannot fool all of the people all the time anymore. We are in such a period. We've come to a time when it is no longer possible to fool all of the people. Therefore, this is one of those great periods in history, a period of opportunity for change. It is not an automatic pulsation of change. It's an opportunity for change. And in such periods, the fate of mankind depends largely upon a handful or a relative handful of leaders. Always has. And there's a reason for it. And therefore, I would say, to get to my point here, crucial point, mankind is born good. The best thing ever invented in the universe. But he does not necessarily mature too well. And therefore, we become susceptible to childish diseases or childhood diseases of humanity among adults. We become corrupt, like bad children in a schoolyard, and like a tyrannical schoolyard tyrannized by bullies. We create a corrupt society in that schoolyard or that society. Then a time comes where people no longer put up with that tyranny, and they recognize it as wrong. And they're open to the possibility of changing it, of changing the rules. We've seen that a few times. But then they often lose that opportunity and slip behind. For that reason, so far, the history of humanity has depended upon leadership. For example, in Christianity, the exemplification of such leadership is the person of Jesus Christ. That's the image of the need for leadership to take a broken humanity, which found itself in the age of Tiberius and Augustus before him, under the rule of evil, under the rule of an evil which had taken over the society of the Mediterranean region. And in this evil, someone came as a leader, as a model of leadership, and sacrificed their life in a manner described by Socrates in Plato's writing on Socrates. To sacrifice their life willingly, not to flee from death, but to stand in place and put their life on the line for the sake of future humanity. That is a leader. Nothing else is a leader in a time of crisis. As we remember Martin Luther King in this connection, in his address, he stood and died not for just African-American people. He died for all humanity in the image of Christ, which inspired him. Or the beginning of modern European civilization, which was made possible by a little girl
not so little, but a girl, Jeanne d'Arc. Jeanne d'Arc refused to flinch in her mission and her courage in going to be burned alive by the Inquisition inspired France to create the first modern nation state and inspired to a great degree the Renaissance launched from Italy, which created modern society and brought us out of the Middle Ages, the darkness of the Middle Ages. It is always the kind of leadership which is exceptional and which has a certain specific quality, a quality which is called a sense of immortality. Huh? And that is what it takes to become a leader, effective leader in times of crisis. What happens, you have people like Bill Clinton, for example. I don't have any enmity against Bill Clinton. He's a very good guy. His choice of girlfriends is not always too good, but but he's a very bright guy. He's performing a useful role still, in some of the time anyway. But the point was, he flinched. He flinched. He does not have, at least not yet, that sense of immortality which is required to become a leader in times of crisis such as this one.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's keynote address at the President's Day Conference 2003. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.